So today I'm going to talk about continuous pipelines. So many of us are familiar with MapReduce and other types of systems that run just once. They start up, they do their work, and then they shut down. But there's a whole host of problems that actually have continuous characteristics to them, but so many times, for the sake of ease of writing the application or whatever the case may be, that we end up writing them in this sort of staccato fashion. So I'm going to address that issue in my talk today, and then talk about one solution that Google has come up with to address it. So again, who am I? I'm Dan Dennison. I'm an SRE manager over the ads quality system at Google for nearly every ad network we have. So that includes search ads, content ads, and display advertising. I'm based out of the Pittsburgh office. What is ads quality? Ads quality seeks to address the ads policy enforcement problem. So it turns out in Google Ads quality, we can't actually show every ad that people give us. Some of them are really bad to show and could potentially wind us up in trouble. So we have to at some point say no to certain types of ads and say yes to other types of ads. The other problem we try to solve is something called the smart ad selection system. So of all the ads showing, which ads are the best? So, but again, today we're going to be talking about pipelines. These are pipelines here inside of a Google data center, but again, I'm obviously referring to the virtual or data processing pipelines. So first things first, let's define some terms. A program that performs periodic or continuous transformations on big data is usually referred to as a pipeline. And so most real-world pipelines are typically organized into a chain series, with the output of one program being the input to the next. Pipelines in a chain series are exceptionally common, and they are typically written this way to make it easier to reason about them and also to enable code reuse. For example, many pipelines that are in a chain series will output intermediate state or intermediate data, and so they might need a janitor process to clean up after them. I happen to operate many pipelines that actually reuse the exact same binary to do that purpose. So what is a periodic pipeline? Periodic pipelines are typically a chained series of jobs executed, typically using a periodic scheduler like cron. They could also be executed using AppWorks. They start up, they do work, they shut down. There's, again, any number of technologies, Hadoop, MapReduce, Pig, Sawzall, you name it, there's all kinds of things out there that you can use to run a periodic pipeline. They are everywhere. You can see periodic pipelines on a desktop computer and on super large clusters. So what's wrong with a periodic pipeline? Plenty of things. Google SRE has found periodic pipelines to be exceptionally fragile, and for several reasons. And not all of these are unique to periodic pipelines, but we seem to find them in observed practice frequently, so I thought I'd call them out. Typically, we have seen, and this is unfortunate, poor monitoring visibility. Unfortunately, this is due to an established practice within how the MapReduce framework works and others of reporting metrics upon completion. So that turns out to be a great idea, except when the problem is occurring during runtime. So then the job crashes, you get a cron job failure notification, and then what? I don't know. Let's find out. Let's go dig in logs. Seems fine, right? Well, so then, you know, another problem, like resource exhaustion. How do you know that you're exhausting some kind of resource, some back end, or some potentially disk resources? Again, poor monitoring visibility leads into these things. Like, in addition to that, exceeding runtime deadlines. It's not uncommon for that 24-hour job, the job that needs to run once a day, before you know it, to run where the runtime takes 36 hours. And then all of a sudden, now you have a problem, right? Because you might have an SLA attached to that job that says, you know, it'd be nice to have the report out once a day, and all of a sudden, it's like, well, it takes us a day and I have to get the report done. Any problem with that? Then another big one here is hanging processing chunks. So again, the big data approach to solving things, because if you have big data, you can't fit it all on one machine. That's why it's called big data. So you have to find a way to cut your problem up into smaller pieces. So the typical pattern with a periodic pipeline is to, before you can advance to the next series in the chain of programs, you have to finish everything from the previous program. So depending on how you chose once upon a time when you wrote the application to chunk your data is what you're stuck with in terms of your worst case runtime. So if you're chunked by customer, and then you have a customer that happens to be really large all of a sudden, now your pipeline is stuck at every stage by that customer that has that extremely large characteristic. So, there's other problems with periodic pipelines. At Google, we schedule jobs that are batched, that are pipelined into the cracks. And we do this to improve utilization. However, part of stuffing things into the cracks is that it might take a little bit longer for the job to start. Or once a job starts, it might have a potentially varying runtime. So even though the job's actual execution time, not including time to schedule, might be fairly small, there might be potentially long scheduling delays. So in order to analyze like how fast or how frequently can you run this pipeline, you need to take into account the time it takes for the job to actually get started, and then the time it takes the job to run. So if your business requirement states that your pipeline needs to have data delivered every 10 minutes, as you can see in this graph, you can't actually run this particular pipeline at a frequency greater than 30 minutes, or otherwise they'll be overlapping. And depending on how the pipeline is set up, that could actually be a serious problem. Now I get to this problem. We all have seen it, the thundering herd. You start up a periodic pipeline, and all of a sudden, you get what you wanted, right? You asked to have maybe 10,000 tasks start, and now you got 10,000 tasks running. So far, so good? Maybe not. What if those 10,000 tasks run into a segmentation fault problem? Now you got a big problem. And so if that segmentation fault occurs, then all of a sudden now you have crash looping 10,000 tasks. So this is what we call the thundering herd problem. Now zooming in on the thundering herd problem, you can get something I call the Mori load pattern. And so as you can see here, we have three kinds of pipelines that are being graphed in the graph. There's a blue one, a red one, and a black one. And everything is fine. The pipelines start up, they shut down, they do their work, what have you. But as you can see from the stack graph of the exact same series on the other side, but you might possibly experience operational issues when you get to the top of the graph at 1.2 million. Sometimes those are hard to tease apart in isolation. You might say, okay, well, we had an outage. Let's shut everything off. We'll run each pipeline individually. Oh, everything's fine. But the problem actually occurs because of the overlapping nature of the problem. So, folks, there's a better way forward than just constantly running these batch jobs. Instead of running data pipelines that deliver streaming business critical information in a staccato fashion and sometimes failing, like this oil pipeline, you can represent your problem in terms of tasks and task groups to reduce latency and increase reliability. So let's talk about workflow. Google Workflow is continuous processing at scale. It's a combination of design patterns. We model continuous pipelines as a series of discrete things to do or tasks. And it can be viewed as a type of model view controller. And before you roll your eyes that I'm referring to UI design in this talk, hear me out. I will address it. And it's dependable underneath very high load, thousands of queries hitting the taskmaster at any second. And there are many correctness guarantees. And again, we offer exactly one semantics globally. The Google Workflow system powers many continuous pipeline systems, including many within Ads Quality, and it has a super simple API, which I won't get into. Combination of design patterns. So the Google Workflow system employs the master-slave distributed systems pattern, which is super old. It's been around forever. And the taskmaster, unsurprisingly, is the master. And the workers are then the slaves. And we also employ this pattern called system prevalence. So in order to get thousands of queries per second at the thing that's actually holding all that state, it's useful to hold all your state in RAM. So then when you're doing the queries, you don't have to block on reading from a big table or disk or who knows what. However, whenever you make a change, we want to block to make sure that we can journal it. Why do we need to journal it? Because if we ever have to roll back, if we ever have a crash, we want to make sure that pipeline is always correct when it starts up again. So we model continuous pipelines as a series of tasks. Each workflow pipeline has an injector component. This component reads the input data and chunks it in as tasks into the first task group in the taskmaster. From there, the workers in the first pipeline stage acquire a lease on those tasks, work on them, and then insert one or more tasks into the subsequent task group for the next stage in the pipeline. Why do we use leases? Because workers can die or act very slowly. And it's nice not to delay work computation or work completion for any of those reasons. For instance, if you're sharding by customer, that very large customer, you want to make sure that there's a bounded period of time. And if you're aware of that problem, you might be able to maintain ownership and extend your lease. But it is important to have leases because, again, things can die, things can fail. And it's important to have a system that can tolerate all of those things. And again, any temporary data that will need to be cleaned up is tracked in a deletion task group, and once all the tasks that refer to the data are gone, the janitor process cleans the temporary files up. Taskmaster is an ACID-compliant task store. So again, atomicity, consistency, isolation, durability. Workflow is very transactional. The whole mutation commits or nothing commits. Workflow is consistent. If you abort a mutation or any binary in the pipeline, including the master, you will end up with valid pipeline state, and you will always pick up where you left off, up to that transaction you did not commit. Concurrency never affects final state. You can have multiple transactions committing at once, and you don't have to worry about it. Durability, every mutation is journaled. No write succeeds without a complete mutation or without a complete journal entry. All right, so workflow can be viewed as a type of model view controller. Again, if you're familiar with UI design, you will immediately recognize the model view controller. Because all pipeline state persists in the taskmaster, it is possible to think of the workflow system as a model view controller pattern. So let's talk about model view controller. Here's the well-known model view controller. This dates all the way back to Smalltalk. The model holds the data, the view presents the data, and the controller, if present, can change the model state and how it's presented through the view. Adapting this pattern for workflow, the model is held in a server called Taskmaster. Taskmaster uses the system prevalence pattern, as discussed, to hold all job state in RAM for fast availability, while synchronously journaling all mutations back to disk. The workers are the view. They get units of work from the Taskmaster. They work on them. And believe it or not, many of them even have a status page you can visit, and you can view what they're working on. The optional controller can do all kinds of things. It might be able to control a work cycle. It might deal with scaling the worker counts. It might trigger a snapshot of the entire system. But all of these components in Model View Controller are present in workflow. So Taskmaster is dependable under very high load with thousands of queries per second. Why does it need to be dependable under high load? Because if you have thousands of workers, you need to be able to deal with those thousands of workers asking for work. Here's an example of a pipeline that I run that uses Taskmaster. So every period in this graph here represents a day. So most of the time, you have fairly stable performance. However, as you can tell, there are spikes. Why are there spikes? Because occasionally, there are non-continuous processes dumping work into this Taskmaster. There's periodic pipelines that I have to deal with. So when the periodic pipeline dumps a lot of work, then I have a spike. But notice the CPU in yellow doesn't spike very much. And that's the important thing. The Taskmaster is very dependable under high load. Correctness guarantees. All work commits require a currently valid lease held by the worker. Now, this is absolutely critical. If a worker has held onto a unit of work for too long and has not asked to extend its lease, when it tries to commit that work, the commit will fail. Why? Because that means almost certainly another worker has taken the work from that worker. Workflow versions all tasks so that if either the task updates or the task lease changes, each operation yields a new unique task ID replacing the previous one with it. So since all pipeline configuration is in workflow, and all that pipeline configuration is stored as tasks inside the Taskmaster in the same form as the work units, to commit work successfully, a worker must own an active lease and reference the task ID number of the config used to produce it. So this is really neat. So when you do a commit, not only do you reference the task ID that you're committing against, you also have an optional field called predicate tasks. And you can say, this task is using the configuration dictated in this task ID, and it relies on the files that are being tracked by the janitor process in these task IDs. So when you do the commit, the system checks to make sure that all those tasks actually exist, because if they don't, you can roll back. And what's really neat about this is now configuration can now be a barrier to your continuous pipeline. If you change the configuration, it'll flush the work that's currently out there. Yes, you waste a fair bit of work, but you can start over again, and now all the new work from that point forward is all consistent with the new configuration. There's no ragged edge. It simply just drops what it's doing and keeps going. The output files and workers are also uniquely named. This is critical because if you have two workers that are working on the same task and they're using the same output file, they're going to step on each other, and that will destroy your correctness guarantee. This actually is really important because occasionally in production, we have this notion of zombies. A zombie in production is different than the Unix notion of zombie because a zombie may be a machine that's running out there that's working on something that other machine that the master may not even be aware that the machine is still running. There might be a split in the network. So let's suppose that that network split gets healed, maybe like a fiber line gets plugged back in again or something. And all of a sudden, now you have a zombie out there that says, hey, I got some work to do, I'm ready to commit. And the taskmaster says, you know what, I forgot about you. You never checked in and maintained your ownership, so your task is not only expired, and I don't actually care that you wrote out all that work into your work file, because that other task that picked up the work, it wrote out to a different file name, so it's all good. So what's going to happen is my janitor will just clean up after that file that you wrote, and life will move on. And again, the taskmaster itself is validated by checking a server token on every operation. You could call this particular correctness guarantee the paranoia guarantee. I'll give you an example. Suppose that you have multiple taskmasters in the same cluster, because you might have multiple pipelines. That seems fine, right? You're trying to increase your utilization. Now, let's suppose that per chance that one of those taskmasters, like the one that you're talking to, moves from one machine to another machine, and then another one moves to the machine that taskmaster was on and happens to bind to the exact same port. Now your workers, they're finishing up with their work, they grabbed a few tasks, they're working on them, finish up with the work, they go to commit. And suppose they never found out that their taskmaster moved to that new machine. They're going to commit that work, and then a rogue taskmaster just accepted it. Now you've blown your correctness guarantee. But we, again, ran into this problem, so we introduced something called a server token. And the server token takes a look at maybe the journal prefix and says, all workers are going to know what the server token is, the master is going to know what a server token is, and when you try to commit, if for some reason you're committing to a different master, the commit will fail. And then typically our workers, because we write everything with what's known as a fail early, fail often methodology, they will then crash, restart, and then get reoriented with the world as it now exists. All right. Moving on. Workflow offers a thing called exactly once semantics globally. So I've so far talked a lot about how Workflow has a transaction journal, which is stored on the local cluster file system. So Google invented this thing called Spanner, and there was a paper that was published about it, and it's a really neat, globally available, globally consistent database. It's fantastic, it's fabulous. It's ubiquitously available, there's many teams within the company that use it. And we're like, so we have this taskmaster, and it thinks of things in terms of files. How are we gonna get this taskmaster to be globally available? And someone says, well, in Unix, of course, in computing, everything can be solved with another layer of indirection. Why don't we build a file system on top of a database? What can possibly go wrong? So we went ahead and did that. So we now have, with our exactly once semantics globally, because we're now storing the journal files on top inside of this database. So Taskmaster, the global workflow, stores its journal in the database, whereas the local workflows will store the journal on the local cluster file system. But now you have a problem, because you're going to have more than one master, obviously, because in order to have global availability, you have to run more than one of these guys. And so how do you resolve that? Well, Google has Chubby. There's certainly Zookeeper available externally. You just need a way of resolving elections. And so you have a distributed lock service like Chubby or Zookeeper. You elect a master, and you move on. But now here's the problem. Not all is well with using Spanner as a file system. It turns out globally available and globally consistent does not correspond to super fast. And so if you're trying to take those thousands of queries per second and then point them at this globally available thing, it doesn't work out so well. So what the compromise solution was, what if we just keep track of like breadcrumbs? We'll just keep track of references in this globally available thing, and then we'll have a heartbeat in there. So they created a task, because of course everything is tasks in the workflow world, just like everything is files in Unix. We'll create a task that has the heartbeat in it, and then we'll create another task with the reference, or a series of tasks with references. So every single time that we see a new piece of data enter the system, we'll check in a new reference in the global and then work on it locally. What happens if your cluster goes away? Oh, that's fine. Because all those reference tasks are stored globally, and then the other workflow will pick up the work. So this gives you application-level failover using heartbeat tasks. It enables something called ragged edge failover. So suppose that your data center goes away. Well, that's no big deal. Global workflow knows what you finished. So the other cluster after the heartbeats expire says, oh, it looks like I have even more work to do than I thought. Let me just solve that problem. And then its controller, inside of it. We'll then just resize the number of workers to the, fit the incoming work, and life goes on. I know I talked about a lot of stuff, but I did give you a diagram. So I'll just review everything I just said. So in here, you have a local workflow. There's your taskmaster, has a stage one, which is the heartbeat stage. It says, hey, I see some new work. Let me go ahead and publish that heartbeat task into the global workflow. And oh, by the way, I better publish a whole bunch of reference tasks, letting them know that I have this work that I'm working on. And then the other cluster may also see new work coming in. So it's also publishing reference tasks for the stuff that it has going on. Let's say that one of them goes away. No big deal. Eventually, the heartbeat task will expire in the global workflow, and then the other local workflow will say, oh, I had more work to do. That's fine. That's no big deal. I'll go ahead and grab it. And then it continues to do all the work and checks in at the very end of the pipeline. That's what that arrow is. It checks in the fact that the work is done and lets delete those reference tasks for the work that we no longer need. So you may at this point be thinking, well, it sounds like Google has a product that does this. So it turns out we announced in January, and I believe it's available now, called Cloud Dataflow. But Google Workflow, bear in mind, is distinct from Google Cloud Dataflow. In Workflow, the flow graph you determine as a developer statically before the program runs. You have to say, okay, I have this series of tasks. I have these task groups that correspond to individual binaries that are working on things in my pipeline. And I'm just going to arrange this just so, and data will come in and data will go out. In Cloud Dataflow, you define your problem, and the system automatically determines the flow graph. So from a developer point of view, that's sometimes easier, because now you don't have to think, right? You just you tell it what you want it to do, and then it will figure out what the query plan should be, and then everything's fine. My suggestion? Ideally, workflow is great. It's super dependable, super highly available. It's journaling, etc. If you have a choice, you should use Google Cloud Dataflow for your next pipeline to avoid falling into this periodic pipeline trap. We don't want any more pipeline explosions. There's too much operational work. Nothing is harder than a rogue 10,000 worker MapReduce. It's terrible. It's really terrible. And then when you go through and you start diagnosing what's wrong with this backend or that backend or the other backend, it's like, oh yeah, what's that thing that's sending all these queries? And then you find out, oh. Folks, we have to get past the periodic pipeline. If you have a truly continuous problem, you should switch to a continuous pipeline. This is one solution. I'm sure that there are many others. Questions?
Yeah. How do you measure the capacity of your system?
How do I measure what?
Capacity. How many tasks you can execute there?
So bear in mind, we're not actually storing the actual data inside the Taskmaster. We're storing pointers to the data. So each individual task tends to be fairly small because it's just saying, this is a unit of work that I'm working on. It's stored over here, wherever it may be. It could be a big table. It could be a file system path, whatever it is. And so the way that we measure things in the Workflow Taskmaster is Google has a ubiquitously deployed monitoring system that looks suspiciously like Prometheus. And and this ubiquitously deployed monitoring system, we routinely would then point at these continuously running tasks like Taskmaster, and there might be a variable exporter called total number of tasks, and then that will tell you what you have, what is actually in the system, and then you can set up alerts saying, maybe I have too much going on, maybe I need to resize the process or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yep.
Do you rechunk between stages of the pipeline?
Yes, so that's optional. I didn't want to get into that particular detail, but this is an excellent question. So some workers will work through something and suppose that they might have a target work cycle time. So I might say, okay, well, I'm going to pull off some work, and I kind of want to get whatever I'm doing done within 30 minutes because that seems like a reasonable period of time to hold on to work, to hold on to a lease. And then they might have a built-in estimator inside the program. And then that estimator says, I'm only done about 10% of this task, and it's like 25 minutes into it. I better split the task and then check in back to my input group a split version of what's left over and then commit the work that I've done. So that is a great question.
So there are some tasks that are not easily pipelineable, if that's a word,
yeah.
Like taking snapshots.
Yeah.
but they all still suffer from the same problems that you outlined earlier, the CPU spikes, the timeouts, and all of that. Any suggestions on how to deal with that?
So the penultimate question is, how do you sort a continuous stream, right? So one strategy for doing this, if your application can tolerate it, is to use a delay process. So one of the stages in your pipeline could just arbitrarily delay things. And you could set cutoffs for the delays. Like maybe initially your delay time might be 45 minutes because that might be a work cycle and a half. And then you might have another delay cutoff at 2.5 hours, saying, well, stuff that arrived even later, we're going to delay a little bit longer just to make sure we pick up all of those things and then sort them. So the specific solution will depend on what the application can tolerate. But you are right. There is a very small number of things that truly, truly have to wait for all their input.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.